Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone. New edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast here. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon. I am thrilled to have a dream team of Mormon historians with me today as we talk about the present and the future of Mormon history, Mormon studies in the academy, and of course, if we're going to talk about the present and the future and trends and the ways that things are going in this world, we'll try to do our best to get a good sense of the past, what has been Mormonism's relationship with its historians, with just the project of doing history itself. We know that for many people, it's often historical incidents or things that they discover that maybe complicate the picture of history that they were presented with in seminary or institute or just your typical Sunday discourse. And so we know that history can be somewhat of a stumbling block. So at some point in the podcast, we'll make sure that we get these good thinkers and articulate, good-souled human beings to weigh in on that. So let me introduce our panel for you. All of them are first-timers on Mormon Matters, but I know that many of them will be names that you're familiar with. I'm going to start with Ben Park because Ben and I, it was our conversations. I think we began them back in February with wasn't it, Ben, that kind of got us thinking that this might be an interesting Mormon Matters topic. So,
correct.
Appreciate you reaching out to me and starting those conversations. I'm glad we're doing it now. Would you tell people who you are or where you are? That's a little bit unusual for our guests and just other stuff about you.
Sure. Thanks, Dan. Well, as Dan mentioned, my name's Ben Park. I'm currently a PhD student in American history out at the University of Cambridge, and I have 2 years left. I have a bachelor's degree in English and history from Brigham Young University and a master's degree in historical theology from the University of Edinburgh before moving here to Cambridge to first do a master's degree in political thought and intellectual history and now working on my doctorate. Though my doctoral work is not in Mormon history, I have dabbled in Mormon history from time to time on the side. I've contributed to the Juvenile Instructor Mormon history blog, as well as Peculiar People, which is a twice-a-week column that's run by Patheos religion website. And I think that should pretty good introduction.
Did you mention your work on the Joseph Smith Papers Project at all?
Oh yes. During my 3 years of undergraduate work at Brigham Young University, I had the wonderful privilege to serve as a research assistant for the Joseph Smith Papers, where I was basically a go for this, go for that for these different research things whenever a different editor like Ron Barney, who's on the panel, would have a question for the volume they're editing, like, I don't know, how Joseph Smith spent so much money on a horse in Nauvoo. Was this a good price for a horse? We would go off and research that to a lot more profound things, like a vague reference to polygamy in Joseph Smith's journal, and a request to require go flesh out what is this talking about. So it was a very fun way to not only get familiar with Mormon history in general, but lots of intricacies of Mormon history that you'd never really be able to look at in depth.
Great. Thanks. Well, I'm excited. Tell stories as we go along here in the discussion. That'll be great. Hey, let's go with young age before the beauty of Ron Barney. So why don't we start with Matt Bowman as our next, ask him to introduce himself. Matt, welcome to Mormon Matters.
Thanks. I will say a couple things about myself, I guess.
Please do.
I currently teach in the religion department at Hampton Sydney College, which is in the aptly named town of Farmville, Virginia.
Oh, interesting.
I finished my PhD last year in May 2011 in the history department at Georgetown. Like Ben, my focus has not really been Mormon history. My dissertation was about evangelicals. However, I nonetheless last summer wrote a book called The Mormon People, The Making of an American Faith, which is sort of a synthesis of all the Mormon history work that's been produced over the last 20 or 30 years that Random House published in January.
Yeah, congratulations. I love the book. I've got it sitting right here on my table next to me.
Thank you.
But no, terrific stuff. And then, Matt, I know you've been involved with Dialogue.
Yes.
Quite intimately. Are you still there as an assistant?
I am, yeah. We have, this editorial team has about a year left.
Good.
So I am associate editor of Dialogue right now.
Good. Well, and then I know you've especially been attuned to what's happening in Mormon studies at large, and so we'll look to you to help us get a feel for what's happening with grad students and programs and projects and all that stuff. So thank you. Don Barney, welcome. We've been mentioning you a few times here. I don't know if you're going to be that familiar to our audience, but I'll tell you, I have just... you and I, of course, we know our own friendship, the history of our time together, but Ron is a great friend of mine, and he's been with the Church Historical Department for many, many years, just retiring last year, but I'll let you tell more of those details, Ron.
It is a pleasure to be here, and especially with two very distinguished coming scholars who've already made a dent in Mormon studies. I did my undergraduate work at Weber State, and then I got a master's degree in history from Utah State University and been accepted for a PhD. I was going to study Spanish borderlands at the University of New Mexico, and we decided to take a little break, and I took a job with the Church History Department with the idea of staying for a couple of years, and the couple turned into 33.
Wow.
And I just retired from church history last year. At present, my wife and I are the executive directors of the Mormon History Association. I still am involved with the Joseph Smith papers. I had something to do with the production of the Joseph Smith papers television series. And I'm also one of the historical editors for the Brigham Young University Quarterly, as it is now called. So that pretty well summarizes me at the moment.
Plus several award-winning biographies you've written, isn't that? Do you mind bragging on yourself a little bit there?
Well, biography is really, in my judgment, the best way to tell the Mormon story, and so I've been very interested in biography, have written three, and I still think it is the finest way to tell the story. It could distort if it's just one biography, but if you have a collection of biographies over a period of time that reflect on similar themes, I think we can get a better look at what our past has been than just by a narrative history. And we've seen some really terrific biographies come out of late, and so I'm very encouraged in that aspect of telling the Mormon story.
Well, thank you, all of you. Any of you know anything about each other that the other person didn't bring up that you think we should bring on for the introduction area?
I would say that Matt is probably knowledgeable of all the exotica of Mormonism that you can think of, whether it be raising the dead, schisms, and so forth. And I would also say that Ron's probably the nicest person at the Church History Department in Salt Lake you could ever come across.
Very good.
thanks, Jim.
I've seen him on his bad days, though, Ben, so. Hey, all right. Well, let's dive in, you guys. I am thrilled to do this, and... as we were talking ahead of time, we were dividing up different areas that we might each talk about. And Ron, I'm going to throw to you first, but with Matt and Ben totally empowered to jump in at any time. And that was if we're going to talk about the present and the future of Mormon history, we need to kind of get a sense of the past. And so if you don't mind, you know, taking us at a sort of the 10,000 foot view level, you know, weave in your own experience, your own observations, begin wherever you want, just to sort of, let's flesh out for this first segment of the church's relationship with history writing with their feelings about history and the service or against faith and things like that?
Without going into the kind of detail that such a survey deserves, I think most people who have looked into the study of Mormon history realize that really not all that much was done in the 19th century. The fact that you didn't get a major biography of Joseph Smith until 1878 with Tullidge, and then another decade to get George Q. Cannon's biography of Joseph Smith, just as kind of an indicator of the rest of the study of the Mormon past. And nobody was in a great hurry to try to give a portrayal in a way that I would call acceptable to modern readers. There were certainly polemical kinds of things, tracts both for and against Mormonism, but the serious study, the academic study of Mormonism, really was elevated in the early part of the 20th century, and then there were just pockets of it. And inevitably, those early forays into academic analysis were iconoclastic. It was just inevitable. And that led to a polarization, I believe, of the portrayal of the Mormon past. And there's been a spillover of that has continued to run. There is those who consider Mormon history, look at it as proving Mormon history. And then there are those who look at it as debunking Mormon history, and they use those notions of polarization and polemics as a substitute for what I think the purpose of history really is, and that is to promote understanding. And I think we're moving farther into that that era of understanding that is at least to me very encouraging. I started in the 1970s in the study of Mormon history and then the employment of Mormon history. And when I came on board in 1977, there's two major things that had happened in the Church Historical Department, as it was called then. In 1972, there was really a transformation of all of the church bureaucracy, and it coincided with the completion of the church office building, the largest building that I guess that still exists in Utah. And what was the church historian's office became the church historical department. And it was separated into several divisions. There was a library division, and there was an archives division, and there was an arts and sites division that now would be described as the museum. And then there was also a history division. And Leonard Arrington, who had been a professor of economics at Utah State University, was hired as the church historian. And it was not an ecclesiastical office. He was a division head. The heads of the other divisions were Florence Jacobson, who had once been the president of the Young Women's Organization for the church, and she ran Arts and Sites. Donald Schmidt came in as the head of the library. And Earl Olson, who had been working in the church historian's office, a grandson of Andrew Jensen, who in many ways was responsible for the success heretofore of the historian's office, kind of did the archives thing, and then they combined it. There's a little bit, and we won't go into to all of that. But by the time I came along, there was quite a track record. And there was an attempt on the part of the church to professionalize both the archives and the history. Leonard Arrington represented the professionalization of the history aspect. And then those who collect and appraise, those who describe and preserve the archivists, that also went through a professionalization that was somewhat coincident with the establishment of the profession of archives all over the country, the establishment of the Society of American Archives or archivists played right into that very much, and most of the people who were involved in the archives in the with the church became affiliated with that organization, employed the academic tools that were being created to better run an archives, and I can witness to the fact that it had a tremendous impact upon what was being done.
So okay, Fran, so just to break up the story for a second here, this is 77 that you're coming on. We know that the Arrington era, at least at the church office building, was from 72 to 82. So you're right in the middle of this. Was everyone on board with this, or were you already at the time that you were coming on feeling like there was a couple of factions or several factions at play?
Well, the commission of the leaders of the church to the church historical department was to better serve the purposes of the church. It was an amazing expenditure of resource to do that, notwithstanding the fact we didn't get a new building, but we did get one entire wing of the church office building. In fact, there had been an archives building that had been proposed decades earlier, and then the Granite Mountain Vault project kind of took over, and the archives building that was planned for downtown was put on hold. And it wasn't until after several years and the interruption of the process by the conference center being built that finally a church history library was established in 2009, I guess, when that building was finished. The difficulty that I think, and I'm speaking a bit out of school here.
We love it when you do that.
The difficulty were, I think there were some mixed signals, and I say that in part from what I have read about and know about Leonard Arrington, that the signals were sent to him of being very open and let's change the way that people look at the Latter-day Saints, and then there were others who were sending signals to him that we've got to protect the integrity of the church, and we do the church no favors by exposing ourselves to the ridicule of others by opening up the materials that we have that in many cases were never meant to be made public. So we had a little bit of a crisis about information and how to control information, how to disseminate it, how to best preserve it. I'd like to think that I was an employee of the church history department when some of these things were worked out to a point where I think we could finally say, we know what we have, we know our collections now, and that wasn't really true prior to the 1970s. Mm. There were little 3x5 card files, and they were everywhere. But it was the advent of technology that allowed the church history department to finally, I think, get intellectual control of the materials that it had. And I don't think the church can or should be faulted because of this ignorance. We were just never in a position to know the vast amount of material that we had. Mm-hmm. I remember a number of years ago that James Hudson, who was the curator of the Library of Congress, the Madison building there, for those who have done research at the Library of Congress, where they hold their manuscripts, James Hudson once came to Salt Lake. Actually, he's been here more than once, but I was asked to kind of be his guide around the archives, and as we were talking about the collections that he administered and the collections that we have, I became a little embarrassed when he said they administer 11,000 manuscript collections, which is vast. But I knew that we had five times that many. that we administered. Now, some of them were not as big as what one would find at the Library of Congress, but others were bigger. So it was a tremendous amount of material, and we simply did not know what we had. And trying to do an abbreviated, though thorough, full-court press on trying to discover what we had was a major thing. And credit really must be given to the leaders who said, we've got to do this. And it began with Elder Howard Hunter, who was the church historian, the ecclesiastical historian when Leonard Arrington came on. And one must remember that there was always an ecclesiastical head to the church history department, along with these division heads.
And is that true? Because, I mean, Arrington was the first professional historian, and prior to that, there was always general authorities that served in this office of church history. Did they always have an apostle or somebody above them? So like when G. Homer Durham was the president, he was a member of the 70, was there still an apostle on top of him that you're talking about?
For advisors, yes. But what became known as the executive director of the church historical department was an ecclesiastical position, and indeed G. Homer Durham, who had been the president, had administrative duties both at Arizona State University and at the University of Utah, PhD, academically very qualified, came in to head this. And I suppose everybody thought that because of his academic background that it would be very smooth sailing as these new academics were brought in to professionalize church history. And the fact was, there was a feature of tension, because they wanted to, I'm trying to think of the language that one critic used regarding Leonard, and I believe it was that he was trying to naturalize Mormon history, that is, to take the divine out of Mormon history and to tell it in natural terms. And that worked for some people, and it didn't work for other people. Because there's no mistake that church leaders today and many of the historians today absolutely see a divine hand in the initiation, the development, and progress of Mormon history. So there's a feature of tension. I came in and I could feel that there was some disparity of feeling in the organization, but it wasn't until 1980 that then there kind of came a change of climate, and what was the history division of the Church Historical Department then became the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute of Latter-day Saint History at Brigham Young University. And then 2 years later, they moved physically as well as in name to BYU, and then left in Salt Lake City in the east wing of the church office building was the church museum, or the arts and sites division, the library, and the archives. And then in 1983, the church museum was built, and so what was arts and sites became the museum division of the department, and then there was a library and an archives. And that's the way it existed for many years until I completed my tenure. When some of those were brought back together, at least under a central operation, with finally, I suppose ironically, the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute for Latter-day Saint History being shut down at BYU.
Right.
And those who were part of it were transferred back to Salt Lake City, where they had been working since the early 70s, and they then melded with the museum folks and with the library and archives to constitute what is presently the Church History Department. There have been a couple of interim leaders of the ecclesiastical leaders of the department since then, G. Homer Durham, Lauren C. Dunn served for a time, Marlon Jensen came in for a stint, John Carmack, and then Marlon Jensen again. And as probably everybody knows, Marlon Jensen has formerly been released, but not technically, as the church historian, and will continue to serve as the mentor to Elder Stephen Snow, and then will be formally released this summer, and probably, I imagine, the ecclesiastical aspect will take place in October. And right now, and I'll make this my closing thing, the church is in pretty darn good shape, knowing who we are and what we have and how best to administer it. And we've learned by good experience and sad experience that I think has helped to create an environment right now that is allowing what I call this era of understanding to flourish. Now, there's certainly not all of the obstacles are overcome, but there have been some fabulous things that have happened just in the last decade, and I think that both Matt and Ben could be witness of that better than I could. So I think my time in there was a very encouraging time. I just was fortunate to be a part of that, and I want to insert one person's name, and then I'll quit.
Please.
And that is the name of Rick Turley. Rick Turley came on board as a young lawyer. He had practiced in Japan and in Salt Lake City. He replaced Earl Olson early in 1986, right on the heels of the murders of Steve Christensen and Kathy Sheets, and the prologue to that, which involved Mark Hoffman. And Rick Turley, this young kid, he wasn't even 30 years old at the time, much has got to be credited to Rick. I think he helped recreate a sense of confidence on the part of the leadership of the church toward the church history department. He led the way in so many things, not the least of which was the first signal that he sent out, and that was his book, Victims, which represented the point of view of the church regarding the Hoffman era. And I think to underestimate Rick's involvement in all that would be to overlook one of the most substantial catalysts to all of what church has become right now. And of course, one of the best things about Rick is a really wonderful, engaging personality. He's exceedingly friendly to everyone, and is a great face of Mormon history. And of course, he will then be the continuity between Marlon Jensen and Marlon Jensen's replacement, as he has been with all of those in the preceding period, up through Elder Stephen Snow, who will begin his tenure in the next few months.
Cool. Thank you so much for that. And just one quick thing. Rick is also one of the co-authors of the Mountain Meadows Massacre set of books that are really trying to get out in front of it, right?
And he was the primary catalyst for that volume.
Right. And the second one that's coming. Volumes. Yeah.
Yeah. And he has resources available to him and a vision in front of him that allows him to do some great things, I think. We can't, I'm sure everybody would like things to move along move faster, and that we would satisfy some of these dangling things that we know can be attended to, but I think church history is in pretty good hands in the long term, and I'm quite optimistic about things.
Great, thank you. I want Matt and Ben to jump in with any pieces of the story that Ron told that you'd want to emphasize. Somewhere along the line, I want to kind of get a little bit deeper into this, you're trying to naturalize Mormon history thing, you're trying to take out the spirit, the divine element, and all that stuff, but I'll let you guys just talk, but there's a few areas that I'll definitely jump in with if you guys don't. So do either one of you want to jump in first?
Sure, I have something to say about this. I think this transition that we might be seeing here is reminiscent of things that have happened in other faiths in the past. I'm thinking particularly of the Americanist controversy in Roman Catholicism at the turn of the last century, by which I mean the 19th and 20th century. in which a series of Catholic scholars faced pressure from their ecclesiastical leaders and in some cases excommunication for presenting the history of Roman Catholicism in a naturalistic sense. And eventually, what these Catholic scholars wrote about, what they thought about, what they said was absorbed more or less into official Catholic positions and the Catholic leadership. And that's one of Catholicism's great strengths, is its ability to absorb what might appear to be deviancy or schismatic groups into this great kind of body of the whole. And I think the tension there, which is quite similar to the tension that has existed in Mormon history over the past 30 years. And it's in some ways a conflict between two ways of understanding what history is. It's quite easy for critics of the church and critics of the church's traditional position on history, by which I mean this sort of emphasis on the sacred and the divine role in history, to accuse the church of being backwards or left behind, being essentially embracing ignorance. That, I think, gives actually scholarly history, academic ways of doing history, too much credit. Academic history is very good at doing certain things, and it's very bad at doing other things. And in certain areas, like I think dealing with the presence of the supernatural in history, it simply has no tools to engage whatsoever. The mistake that's often made is assuming that simply because scholarly history, academic ways of understanding the past, the tools which academic history gives us to understand the past, because these things can't address the supernatural, therefore the supernatural can be given no credence whatsoever.
Right.
That is, I think, alarmingly limiting. And there are actually really, I think this is a great strength for religious studies. Religious studies is a discipline which is pushing against this question. There are a number of really cutting-edge scholars in religious studies who are saying, well, look, we can't deal with things like the first vision. We can't deal with apparitions of Mary. We can't deal with Muhammad seeing the angel Gabriel. What are we going to do with that? We have, to date, simply said, well, we can't deal with it, so we're not going to simply engage at all. We're going to dismiss these things as superstition. We're going to accuse them of being not true, quote-unquote, in the empirical, rational sense that the Academy has given us. But that simply doesn't do the human experience enough credit. And so that, I think, is a conversation that Mormons really need to be a part of. And I think something that has gone on the other side of this from the church's perspective is a particular way of understanding what sacred history is. You know, we might think of sacred history as being simply history that accepts things like the first vision and accepts, well, okay, sometimes perhaps presidents of the church speak with God. And God gives them direction, and then they make decisions based on what God tells them to do. That's one way of understanding it, certainly. But I think it would do Mormon thinkers well to consider other ways in which this conversation has been had. There are a group of evangelical historians in the Academy right now who, people like George Marsden and Mark Knoll, who are writing history of evangelicalism, but they're also writing history from an evangelical perspective. Marsden, especially, who has written probably the best study of Protestant fundamentalism in America, is quite explicit in the afterwards to that book that he understands history to be a place in which God's purposes are worked out. However, he also says, if I want to have a conversation with other historians, I can't simply say that. I have to do it in their language. Mm. I have to translate my religious beliefs about the way the past works into the language of footnotes and references and citations. And he's done that. Now, we could argue, and there are religious historians who do argue about whether or not he's successful in that. But I think this is one way of kind of breaking this impasse between God told us to do things on one side and people saying, well, of course there is no God because we can't footnote him on the other. And that, I think, is where Mormon studies might go. And I think it would be a really fruitful way to take what we're doing here.
Wow, awesome. Thanks, Matt.
Sure.
Ben, do you want to jump in with anything?
Sure, yeah. Well, first, give a hearty amen to both what Ron and Matt have said. It's been great. And I think to kind of merge the professionalization process that Ron was mentioning, as well as these discursive methods that Matt was mentioning, I think we can look at the development that has taken place over the last three decades that Ron alludes to, this professionalization, almost as an entrance into these conversations that Matt then alluded to. I mean, in the 1970s and the 1980s, there is the professionalization process, which is basically, let's get our records and our record keeping and our access and our archives up to a certain standard, and that's, you know, professional, but still at the same time, it's still very inclusive. As Ron mentioned, one of the messages, I think he did a good job at saying there was a disagreement on what those messages might have been, but one of the messages is we're presenting these things for those within the kingdom. We're presenting these things for members of the church to understand what our history is. But I think what's happened even within the last decade is you see almost the next step or the logical progression of that process, which means now we have to enter into dialogue with others about this process, which then gets into the very type of discourse that Matt was talking about. I think we see this, especially with the Joseph Papers Project. Just the fact that they went and they got their endorsement from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission, I think speaks volumes. Because by going out and trying to get that approved, saying we want an endorsement from you, that means we want to enter into a conversation. The opinions of those outside the church matters. I think you've seen that in just this last year, the Church Historical Department in Salt Lake hosted the Documentary Editing Foundation or conference. I forget the actual name of the group, but I think they're wanting to enter into these conversations. That I think is a very important development that needs highlighting.
Terrific. Ron, anything with those two guys? Otherwise I just want to kind of take these last couple of decades a little bit deeper. So, but Ron, anything on other ways that the church is professionalizing, or at least Or are you seeing the discussion that Matt raised happening in the department itself?
I think that there are a number of Latter-day Saints who have been involved in history who are not only thrilled but delighted with the emergence of what Matt described, and that is a certain legitimization of looking at religions that profess their origins and then what sustains them, the in numinous experiences that you cannot appraise empirically. And so Latter-day Saints, I think, are feeling that maybe we're going to be able to express some of the things that we have been unable to express in an environment that will not be met with hostility, and yet we will have people who profess some sympathy, at least to our claims. Maybe they won't buy into them, but they'll be sympathetic to the process. There's a handful of I'm thinking of Harold Bloom, of Wayne Hudson in Australia. We've even seen Dr. Aziz Atiya at the University of Utah, the great Coptic scholar who looked at Mormons and said, we've got to give these people some credit. There's something happening here, and you just cannot debunk the entirety of it because we lack the vocabulary or the features of conversation that will allow us to come to understanding. So I think some things are happening right now that are very encouraging that that Matt and Ben have alluded to.
Cool, thanks. Let me do this. This is a Mormon Matters podcast. It's part of a community of podcasts and, you know, discussion groups and whatnot that kind of are under this larger umbrella of the Open Stories Foundation. And I would guess, as I have been a part of this for the last year or two, there seems to be, you know, a story of church history and the department in which Leonard Arrington is a hero and Mike Quinn is a hero and you know, Elder Packer with the mantle is far, far greater than the intellect talk, and then the you know, him and Mike Quinn and Newsweek and all that stuff. And we get this story of, you know, one group that wants pure open access, the other one that wants to shut it down and wants hiding, and, you know, the archives are closed and then they're open and now they're pretty much open again, and there's the whole business of they want to hide it from the members and things like that. And I sense that this isn't the best way to frame, you know, these last 2 to 3 decades. And I just would love for you guys to weigh in a little bit more on, like, an argument of a more specific. I know, Matt, you did a good job of taking us to the Catholics, but we didn't really tie it back to particular personalities or arguments within Mormonism. And so, for instance, would somebody to jump in with what Elder Packer was trying to say, and when you called it the voices that were trying to say you're trying to naturalize church history, what was his argument, as well as, you know, sort of Mike Quinn's response that led to this new Mormon history and all that kind of stuff? So
yeah, I could jump in there.
Please.
I wrote a blog post called The Mantle is Far, Far Greater Than the Intellect, A Vindication, which I've since been working on turning into an article.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, I think what Packer and what Elder Oakes, who's also expressed thoughts along
right.
what Packer said in this talk, what they're doing is actually far more interesting intellectually than they're usually given credit for. And it's because I think this story has usually been framed, as you say, as one kind of truth versus authority, right? Which is sort of this classic dialogue in American history and American narratives about ourselves. But it's also, I think, an expression of what has been a sort of the limits of Mormon studies to date, which is that Mormon studies for a long time were basically all about academic history and academic ways of doing history. And I think if we had, back in the 80s, a real sort of serious and intellectually nuanced and powerful dialogue in Mormon theology, I think Packer and Oakes' talks would have been received with far greater interest, because I think they are really theologically interesting, and they're expressive of, I think, this notion of sacred history, which is a real kind of robust and interesting branch of theology more generally, that goes back to Jonathan Edwards and then to St. Augustine even. And I think it's fair to put what Packer and Oakes were doing in conversation with people like that.
So tell us, what were they doing? I want to make sure that, I'm not sure, we can't assume that our listeners have all read that. So
Augustine really begins this with his book City of God, in which he talks about, and he's facing, when he writes City of God, he's only a couple of decades from the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, and the Goths and the Vandals and all of these other barbarian tribes are roaming up and down the Italian peninsula. And Augustine, of course, is bishop of the city of Hippo, in the Roman Empire, and he is a Roman, and he thinks of history in terms of kind of this narrative that the Romans had been presented with, which was essentially the grand ascent of Rome, and Rome brings civilization, and Rome brings enlightenment, and the barbarians are terrible and horrible and are destroying all of these things. And so what Augustine is trying to do then is say, well, if this first thing is true, if Rome is, in fact, the harbinger of civilization, and Rome has become Christian, and the Roman government is involved in promoting Christianity, then why on earth is God allowing the barbarians to tear this all apart? And so he has to come up with a theology of history, a way of thinking about why God might allow this, and a way of thinking of the ways in which God might be involved in history. Then skip forward, you know, a millennia and a half, and you're to Jonathan Edwards, who writes this massive sermon series called A History of the Work of Redemption, in which Edwards argues that essentially the driving motive force behind history is God's work of salvation. And this brings up all sorts of interesting questions about cause and effect in history, about what things we credit to make other things happen, about why it is exactly that we think like wars and battles and economic depressions and migrations, why do we think those things are the most important things in history? It's because we, as in terms of academic history, the sort of history that emerged from the Enlightenment, we basically assume that human action is the thing that drives history forward, and that we should understand history in terms of understanding humans making decisions. Mm-hmm. And the dominoes of cause and effect go forward from there. Now, this is perfectly fine if what you're doing is trying to have an academic conversation among people of wildly different backgrounds and beliefs. But once you bring in people like Edwards or Augustine, who say, well, no, maybe the driving force behind human history is in fact the fall of Adam and Eve. Or maybe the driving force behind all of human history is Christ reaching out his arms and trying to gather in people into his church. And we should understand World War II, for instance, in terms of the fall, or in the terms of Christ's work of redemption. Then that really changes the game. And what Edwards and Augustine are doing, and what Oakes and Packer are doing, is not academic history. It's not history which assumes that human agency is the single motive force, and thus human agency is something that we can document through archives and footnotes and all of that, but rather that there are supernatural forces at work in history. This is a, as I've said, a intellectual endeavor with a long and distinguished history, and it's, I think, a really important thing that has characterized much of how human beings in our totality as a species have thought about what history is. It's not necessarily what the academy thinks history is, but that may speak as much to the limitations of the academy as anything else.
I'd like to jump in for just a minute, just to contrast that, what Matt was presenting, and to really show that what happened in the 70s and 80s is really just a clash of methodologies. Those who took part in the Arrington Spring, were trained in what the Academy calls the new social history, something that had roots in the 1950s and kind of came into fruition in the 1960s and 70s, where most of the practitioners of New Mormon history received their graduate training. This emphasized two things. One, a point that Matt pointed out, they're really interested in human decisions. They're really interested in the rationale. And number two, a step beyond that, the rationale of the common people, because there is an expressed skepticism towards leaders, towards authorities, towards founders. You get during this period lots of works that are very critical of, say, the founding fathers of America, because they want to look at kind of the bottom-up type of history. And that has an inherent skepticism toward authority. And so when you get that clashing against a sacred history that Matt mentions, that has a God at the center, and within Mormon history, prophets and apostles, I think you have a really clash of interests and priorities. And I think right. That played a big role into those battles.
If I could throw in also, another, I think, aspect of the new Mormon history, and it's the social history that it emerges from, that Ben refers to, was a real sort of interest in quantitative methods, in research through numbers, in aggregations, in kind of mathematical, almost mathematical study of the past. And it makes this sort of history, I think, very, very good at looking at the trees, and less interested so much in the forest.
Mm, cool, yeah.
Let me just add one little feature here that is a little bit outside of the impact of the academy and the styles of history that had emerged at the time was the fact of personality. I think there was a lot to do with the 1970s, the 1980s, that had a whole lot to do with the personalities of the primary individuals who drew the most attention during that period of time.
So, in other words, personality doesn't mean right or wrong. It just means personality, temperament, things like that, right? You don't make moral judgments based on that.
Correct.
Well, good. And did I cut you off? Because it sounded like you're okay.
No.
Well, I wanted to ask you. I loved, Matt, how you led into this with, you know, what Elder Packer, Elder Oakes, and things were arguing there actually have interesting theological histories and backgrounds and stuff like that. Ron, I wanted to kind of hear from you. As they were making those statements, was Arrington and were many of you, like, recognizing what Matt says about that? That, yeah, this is a valuable perspective. Or, again, I'm just trying to complicate this black and white either-or kind of story that I think I've heard, you know, expressed over the while. Were you guys taking that seriously, or was there this group of those old fossils, those guys don't have, you know, I mean, we just got to plow ahead with letting the chips fall where they may.
Well, first of all, I've got to qualify where I come from. I'm not as smart as Matt is. So I was never looking at this as part of kind of a global perspective on what was happening in the world per se. We were, as I've said to a number of people of late, we were making the sausage in the factory, and we felt like we knew what we were doing, and most of the people that were a part of this group were people of faith. Although I confess my own was challenged immensely during that period. I'm going through a little personal procedure now of making an electronic copy of all of the journals that I've kept since 1968, and I'm up to 1988 right now, and just the rehearsal of that period has not only been enlightening but very painful to revisit that time when I'd certainly never been prepared to encounter some of the things that I did. But I would like to think that my circumstance at present, where I still profess to be a believer and still profess to be a practitioner of Mormonism, matured through that period of, some would call it a crucible, or maybe a period of refinement that I know affected many other people. I know that there are many who kind of peeled off, saying, you know, we don't need this, because some of what the church was offering was flying in the face of some of the realities that the world was encountering, the post-1960s, the disillusionment with authority. That all spilled over into the feelings of many toward the church, and there was some fallout from that. I don't know if that answered your question just right, but I sense a transitional period that I think in the long run, especially from hindsight, is going to be looked upon as being a healthy period, where we were able to muddle through some of those things that we'd never been faced with previous to that. And in many ways, I think we've come through that in a way that we can move to a new level where people will treat us with some respect, because we have we've turned the spotlight on ourselves, and we haven't run and hid in the corners.
Yeah, boy. Yeah, you didn't answer my exact question, but you actually probably took us into an area that's important to go into, which is what happens in a person's faith crisis when they are confronted with the stark realities of this or that. And so just to complete the earlier thought, though, with Elder Oaks. And,
now, what did you ask me?
Well, it was just like, were you guys hearing Elder Oaks and Elder Packer and really mulling it and seeing their points? Or I just wanted to kind of, my guess is you were. But yet I think the history that's sort of been told in these overarching views with good guys and bad guys, it makes it more of a like, oh, these couple of guys trying to stop the progress of real professional history, and we'll just thumb our nose at them, and then that's what led them to finally kick you guys out to BYU and all that stuff. I just was trying to complicate that.
One of my favorite writers once spoke before a college assembly, and then after he spoke, he asked the question, he said, opened it up to questions, and a question was asked, what is the most important thing that you've learned in all of your professional life? And he fired right back, it is how to deal with ambiguity. And I think if people look at this as in a binary way, that it's black or white, or on or off, or right or wrong, I think we're going to walk away, in many of us, disillusioned, and the process isn't nearly as interesting as if we can recognize that there is inevitably going to be some conflicts between the way people look and how they treat information. There are people who are going to want to stay in the greenhouse their entire lives. They never want to get outside. They don't even care if the root systems of the vegetation around them sink deep. They don't care because they want a nice temperature. They want a constant humidity. They want plenty of light, and they love the green. The people who venture outside of the greenhouse because they need more and expect more will have to recognize, though, that there's some really nice things in the greenhouse, and they don't want to jettison those entirely. They want to be able to, in some ways, keep feet in both camps, and it's difficult, and it always will be difficult. There's no silver bullet. There's no easy way to solve this, and I, for one, have at least learned to, I like ambiguity. And it doesn't make everybody happy, and in some ways it's looked upon as being a cop out, or that you can't maintain the faith that is required. But I feel like my faith is more mature and more intense at present than ever in my life.
Right, even though, as you're acknowledging, you're doing something with these 20 years of very difficult moments for you in through your journaling.
Yeah. I'm just trying to be honest.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.